You can listen to all episodes of Leonard ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
The Ogallalas came and made a presentation to the American Indian Movement and told about the terrorism that was going on, told about the homes that were being shot up, the people that were dying, and how much fear they had. You know, these were older ladies making these presentations.
This is Leonard Peltier speaking to filmmaker Michael Apted back in 1991 for the documentary Incident at Oglala.
It was real. It wasn't something they were just imagining, and they needed some help from the American Indian Movement. One of the things that we've got to do, we can't just be going around here claiming to be American Indian Movement members and we're concerned about people and everything else. So we've got to really start doing stuff. You know, building community gardens, chopping wood, hauling water, whatever they needed done. That's your responsibility. That's what a warrior's responsibility is. Not just prancing around with a gun in their hand and thinking, showing everybody they're tough. I said, that is, in our society, that's not a warrior's role, right?
You're listening to Leonard, a new podcast series about Leonard Peltier, the longest-serving political prisoner in American history. I'm Andrew Fuller.
And I'm Rory Owen Delaney. We've spent the last year working to share Leonard's story with a new generation of people. Who he is, how he ended up behind bars, and why we believe he deserves to go free. And at long last, in this episode, we're visiting the site of the Pine Ridge Shootout. And we'll be hearing directly from some of the people who were there that day, including Leonard Peltier himself.
So we're getting very close to that place, Oglala. See that house over there, the red roof?
This is our guide, Edgar Bearrunner, a Lakota tribal historian and a former president of the Porcupine District of the Pine Ridge Reservation. Edgar is the son of Oscar Bearrunner, a World War II veteran and respected elder who took part in the armed occupation of Wounded Knee, South Dakota, in 1973. 2 years later, on June 26th, 1975, when the firefight broke out on the Jumping Bull Ranch between two undercover FBI agents and members of the American Indian Movement, Edgar was there. But before he takes us to the ranch, we probably need to do a quick recap. There are so many moving pieces in this story that we've found it's good to regain our footing from time to time and just review the events that led up to the shootout on Pine Ridge.
In 1968, indigenous activists in Minneapolis, fed up with centuries of oppression and abuse, founded AIM, the American Indian Movement. Soon, chapters of the organization spread nationwide, and in 1969, a coalition of protest groups, including AIM members, calling itself Indians of All Tribes, seized the island of Alcatraz in San Francisco Bay and held it for nearly 2 years. In 1970, inspired by the success of the Alcatraz action, a group called United Native Americans marched in and occupied the Mount Rushmore National Monument. The very existence of the mountain-sized memorial, as Edgar Bearrunner explained in episode 2 of this podcast, is a direct violation of the 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty that established the Great Sioux Nation. But even more importantly, Mount Rushmore defaces Pahasapa, the Black Hills, the most sacred land in the Lakota universe. In 1971, after the Alcatraz occupation had ended, leader Richard Oakes was murdered by a white supremacist named Michael Morgan. And in 1972, a jury found Morgan not guilty, saying he'd shot Oakes in self-defense, even though Oakes wasn't armed.
Enraged by Morgan's acquittal, a caravan of protesters embarked on the Trail of Broken Treaties, a cross-country protest that launched from California and landed in Washington, D.C. the week before Richard Nixon's re-election. When the Nixon administration refused to meet with the activists, demonstrators took over the Bureau of Indian Affairs building in Washington, D.C. and refused to leave for 6 days. 1972 was also the year Dick Wilson was first elected Tribal Council Chairman of Pine Ridge. Almost as soon as he got into office, evidence mounted that he was embezzling money to enrich his friends and fund his militia. The Guardians of the Oglala Nation, the Goon Squad. And so, traditional members of the Tribal Council brought impeachment charges against Wilson in February of 1973, and several hundred Lakota, joined by members of AIM, marched on Pine Ridge in protest, demanding Wilson's resignation.
But Wilson presided over his own hearing, and perhaps unsurprisingly, secured an acquittal. So the activists seized the village of Wounded Knee, the same site where, in 1890, U.S. Army soldiers killed more than 300 unarmed Lakota, half of whom were women and children. As we heard in detail in part one of this episode, the U.S. government had backed Wilson's election in part because Wilson was willing to hand over the Sheep Mountain Gunnery Range uranium reserves, 1/8 of the Pine Ridge Reservation. On top of that, AIM had embarrassed the White House repeatedly with high-profile occupations of public property. So when AIM took Wounded Knee, Dick Wilson called on the feds, and the U.S. Marshals and the FBI rolled onto Pine Ridge in tanks. After a 71-day siege that left two activists dead but ended in a stalemate, the feds put their knee on AIM's neck, arresting nearly 600 members and sympathizers on trumped-up charges.
More than 90% of the charges were later dismissed, but the prosecutorial bullying succeeded in tying up the movement in years of costly court trials. And as we also heard in part one of this episode, for the next 2 years, Dick Wilson's goon squad sought revenge for Wounded Knee and carried out their reign of terror, killing at least 64 AIM members and supporters between 1973 and 1975. They burned down houses. They ran people over with cars. They poisoned people, stabbed people, ambushed people with shotguns, kidnapped people in the middle of the night and executed them. So if you were an AIM member camping out on Pine Ridge in 1975, you knew it was just a matter of time before they came for you.
The shootout incident in Oglala, the conspired incident created by the federal government to serve as a distortion and to take our minds away from the real land issues, dispossession issues, the illegal acquisition of and transfer of land from the tribe, our assets, to the federal government.
This is Edgar Bear Runner again.
Everything's all documented, so I'm not making this up. It's a mineral studies report for the Pine Ridge Reservation pertaining to the 133,000 acres of prime tribal land that was noted to have a great amount of oil, gas, hot water, uranium, yellow cake uranium on that piece of land. And so that land is so valuable, the United States wanted it. And the United States just couldn't get it like that. And so the United States, in order to get it, they had to create a situation, to create an incident that would overshadow the corruption and the illegal land transfer. So Leonard Peltier, the incident at Oglala, was created to serve as a smokescreen to cover up the wrongful acts and the misdeeds of the federal government.
On June 26, 1975, two FBI agents assigned to the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, Jack Kohler and Ronald Williams, were investigating the whereabouts of a young Indian, Jimmy Eagle, who was wanted for the theft of a pair of cowboy boots.
That's Robert Redford, narrating the opening of Michael Apted's documentary, Incident at Oglala. We played excerpts of the film in episode one, and it's worth revisiting here, quickly, to set the scene for the story we're about to hear. The next voice is Norman Zagrosi, the former assistant FBI regional head in South Dakota.
They had a warrant for Eagle, and so they turned around and started following the vehicle, which we believe led them into the Jumping Bull complex.
Back in June 1975, journalist Kevin McKiernan reported for NPR from Pine Ridge, and he spoke with a government official in the days after the shootout who echoed Zagrosi's explanation for why agents Kohler and Williams entered the Jumping Bull compound to arrest a teenager named Jimmy Eagle for, as you just heard, stealing a pair of cowboy boots.
What they were doing at the time they were killed They were going in to see if Jimmy Eagle was anywhere in the area, and if he was, they were going to arrest him.
But there are two problems with this story. The first is factual. After the agents' bodies were later recovered from the Jumping Bull compound, it turned out there hadn't been a warrant for Jimmy Eagle after all. The second is contextual. Indian reservations are sovereign, at least on paper. But under the Major Crimes Act passed in 1885, federal government has jurisdiction to investigate specified felonies such as murder, manslaughter, rape, assault with intent to kill, arson, burglary, and larceny. Theoretically, the taking of cowboy boots could be prosecuted as larceny, although probably only as a misdemeanor. It certainly pales in comparison to the dozens of uninvestigated murders of AIM supporters that took place on Pine Ridge between 1973 and 1975. Case in point. Less than a month before the Jumping Bull incident, Edith Eaglehawk, her four-month-old daughter, and her three-year-old grandson were murdered when Albert Coombs and Mark Clifford, two well-known goons, ran her car off the highway.
As of June 26, 1975, Mark Clifford, an accomplice in that triple homicide, hadn't even been questioned by the FBI, let alone arrested. And that's why people like Edgar Bearrunner have a hard time believing the FBI cared about a missing pair of cowboy boots. It was an open secret that AIM members were camping out at Jumping Bull. And the FBI knew AIM co-founder Dennis Banks, who was on trial for his role in the Custer Courthouse riots, was commuting daily between the courtroom and Ogallala, because they'd been surveilling the ranch for weeks. And they seemed eager for an excuse to visit. Here's Edgar again.
COINTELPRO had to find a way to justify creating a cover-up.
Edgar's referring here to the FBI's covert intelligence program. Between 1956 and 1971, the domestic spying program surveilled just about everyone the federal government considered a threat. The Black Panthers, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King Jr., Corky Gonzalez and the Chicano movement, and multiple leaders of the American Indian movement.
Then Peltier was the fall guy. They had to find one person to be responsible for this whole shit. You know? Land invasion, land dispossession, the wrong criminal investigation at the wrong place.
Edgar Bearrunner has never publicly shared his recollections of June 26th, 1975, until now.
On May 28th, 1975, I turned 25 years old. And to run for a public office in tribal government, you have to be 25 years old. So I ran for office and was elected. I became the district president for Pork Pride. I used this official capacity to intervene in the Ogallala incident.
Edgar wasn't living at the AIM camp on the Jumping Bull Ranch. He lived in Porcupine, the Pine Ridge district adjacent to Ogallala. But word spreads fast on the reservation. And not long after shots were fired on the compound, Edgar was there.
Porcupine is 25 miles from Pine Ridge. I talked to the medicine man. He prayed and gave me a pipe. So I walked in the Ogallala compounds with the white man call it peace pipe, you know. But we call it sacred pipe. So I took that in, Ogallala, praying that the Almighty would help me to provide freedom to all those people that were in there.
When Edgar showed up at the scene, no one had clear information yet about what exactly was happening on the Jumping Bull Ranch. All anyone knew for sure was that there was an American Indian movement camp on the compound, that two FBI agents had entered the property that morning, that shots had been fired, and that the agents were no longer responding on their radios.
I was out on the perimeter, and a young Indian by the name of Edgar, I think it was Edgar Bearrunner, came to me and indicated he'd been in touch with our area office, and said that he felt that the shooting should cease and there should be negotiations.
This is Bureau of Indian Affairs Superintendent Kendall Cumming, speaking with NPR's Kevin McKiernan on the site of the shootout in the immediate aftermath of the firefight.
At that time, the situation was rather tense because most of the people didn't know that the agents were, no one knew of our people or FBI, that the agents were dead at that time. It was thought they might be alive and wounded. And they were very much concerned about them lying out there in the sun and suffering. And so the possibility of an assault was imminent.
So Edgar Bear Runner shows up.
And this is Kevin McKiernan, who was a house guest of the Jumping Bull family the night before the shootout, talking with us last year while we were collecting interviews for this podcast. We'll be hearing his perspective on the events of June 26, 1975, in detail next episode.
Oh, this is the key part of what happened at Oglala that day. Was there was a visiting superintendent from the Southwest. I think he was from New Mexico. His name was Cummings. And he was just there on a rotation for a couple of weeks until they could get the real superintendent who would be from there. And so he was the man in charge, the number one. And Edgar Bearhunter came up to him and he said, look, I'm the duly elected representative from this area, and you have to let me go in. I'll try to negotiate for them to surrender, for them to come out. And this guy was just flummoxed. This Cummings superintendent, acting superintendent Cummings, said, okay, you can go in there. I'll give you about 10 minutes, and you can go in there and negotiate the surrender. And okay, so then he put out the order for a ceasefire, and everybody stopped shooting.
I mentioned this to Mr. Bearhunter and suggested he go down and talk to him about an immediate ceasefire so that we could get out the agents.
Kendall Cumming again.
He went down. I don't know who he talked to, if he talked to anyone. He came back after going down in the area of the houses and indicated that the men were dead. He thought they were dead, and so there was no rush, that there would be plenty of time and there should be negotiations. And he talked about what would happen if there was an assault and large groups of people would come in from other places, this type of thing.
The day of the shootout, when I became an official authorized mediator, I came down here as a tribal public official to quell a massive bloodshed here on this Jumping Bull facility.
After the break, Edgar takes us to Jumping Bull Ranch. To help Leonard, you can purchase his artwork at whoisleonardpeltier.info. All proceeds go to fund his legal defense, so check out his stuff. He's super talented. You can also help Leonard on social media by tweeting messages of support for Leonard's clemency to @POTUS and @RealDonaldTrump. As well as to Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump. We know the president loves Twitter, so tweet, tweet, tweet. Let's keep Leonard in his timeline and mentions.
We could park somewhere right here and walk.
Yes, okay.
Right by that tree is a big bank down the other way, so no, it should have happened down there. Are you up, Marty? Mm-hmm. Come on.
Edgar has led us on to the Jumping Bull Ranch. The compound is all but abandoned now. In the aftermath of the firefight, the FBI raided all the buildings on the property, and the damage they did was never repaired. The morning of the FBI raid, Harry and Cecilia Jumping Bull weren't on the ranch. By the time they were allowed to return, their home had been destroyed. Here's Kevin McKiernan back in 1975, speaking with Cecilia Jumping Bull in the days after the siege.
Mrs. Jumping Bull, you say that many things were destroyed in your house during the search which followed the shootout on Thursday between the FBI agents and those in and around the house. Can you tell me about that?
I want to say something to the government, that the government don't have respect for me. So that's why I'm really wary about that, because he don't even care for me.
He meaning the government?
Yes, the government.
You mentioned that there were two pictures, and you showed me one of them. The two pictures showed they were in frames behind glass and showed the pictures of your two nephews who died in the armed services, yes, and your son who died in the armed,
yes,
services.
Three pictures, and well, they are killed in a war. Those boys, three boys, got killed in a war.
Which of the pictures has the bullet hole through it from the shooting that took place a few days ago at your house?
Those two, my nephews. And one of the pictures that got a bullet hole, is that's my sister's boy, got killed in action in a Korea War in 1950. And one of my nephew got killed in France in 1944, in September. So I wanna give it back. I wanna return those flags to the government.
These are the flags which were given to you,
yes,
by the government when your son died?
Yes. Because the government don't have respect for me. So now on, I don't want to keep those United States flag and those...
Plus the Purple Heart, she says.
Purple Heart and Gold Star.
He wants to return them.
So I want to be returned those to the government. I'm going to send back to the president for a full sheriff because the government shoot me about 3 days ago and damaged all my house and property. And I don't know why he done that for me. Because I don't do any wrong, and I don't do anything wrong to the government and the law.
Mrs. Jumping Bull was hospitalized with a nervous breakdown the day following this interview. Her son Calvin told me the family had no plans to return to their home.
As we walked through the chest-high clover on the Jumping Bull's land, we asked Edgar to take us back to the morning of June 26, 1975. After he'd arrived from Porcupine, armed only with his sacred pipe, Edgar convinced the FBI and BIA agents on the scene to allow him to enter the property alone so he could begin negotiations with the AIM members who remained trapped on the compound.
They had my marked on the forehead. I shouldn't turn around, drop, and they could kill me on the spot. So I had my pipe in the hand, and I went down there. And the process was going down. I seen the car over there. And then when I walked by him, there's two guys laying there. There's one car there. And two guys had moccasins and they had fringes on the bottom. And the FBI said, no, we had FBI's in suit and tie. That's bullshit. They lied right there.
In other words, the FBI agents looked like two of Dick Wilson's goons.
I came to this location, and when I came to the buff, the end of the hill here, I was summoned by SWAT teams down here along the creek bed down there. And his agent said, are they breathing? I said, hold on. I look and I seen the flies come in the mouth and go out and the dry blood, you know, waiting for the backs to go up, nothing like that. No, so I said, they're not alive. If these are your agents, they're not alive. They're both dead. So then when I went back out here, I made my second trip in because the BIA superintendent wanted to know. He wanted to verify that those two that I seen were agents, and they were dead. And so I brought him back. Him and I just walked straight down in there. They hollered at him, the BIA superintendent, the agents, don't touch the car, don't touch the body, don't touch anything. And this time the BIA superintendent said, yeah, they're both dead. That prevented the rush to come in and save him and to end up killing all the people that were here.
Edgar was at Jumping Bull expressly to negotiate between AIM and the federal government. But Edgar didn't believe that the FBI would uphold their end of the bargain. even if he could convince AIM to put down their weapons and surrender peacefully.
I went in there knowing that I wasn't getting a hold of anybody, but I was just killing time, letting that sun go. So when I walked out of Oglala, the bottom of the sun was on top of the ridge, way over there, you know, way over yonder.
Edgar was really there, he maintains, to slow down the proceedings and to give the AIM members time to escape.
25 additional FBI agents have been brought in to aid in the search for some 16 Indians who engaged in a gun battle Thursday, killing two FBI agents.
This audio is from the NPR broadcast of Kevin McKiernan's reporting from Oglala.
There are now nearly 150 agents searching the sprawling hills of the reservation. The investigation is now also spread outside the reservation into several states. Spokesman for the FBI says they have a pretty good idea as to the identity of the 16, although no warrants have yet been issued.
One of the people the FBI was searching for was a young woman named Jean Roach, who was just 14 at the time.
Jean lives in Rapid City now, but we ended up meeting her at the annual powwow in Pine Ridge Village, where she was selling turquoise jewelry.
Okay, my name is Jean Roach. Excuse that, because I just not lost all these.
Oh, yeah, no problem. Okay. Yeah. They're just getting the level right now anyway.
Okay, from the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe. I've been raised in Rapid City, South Dakota. First time I came here to the reservation, I was probably about 14. I was sent over here because I couldn't behave myself in the city. So my mom was best friends with Leonard. We knew some of the people here. They were establishing a, what actually was going on is the Oglala community was tired of the goon squad mentality. People were being killed and shot at, and when people had ceremony, they were being attacked, shot at. So they developed like a security, and more or less like the Merry Maids and security. So there was a bunch of us who came back from the AIM conference.
AIM hosts an annual conference, and in 1975, they held it in Farmington, New Mexico. Farmington is located in the Southwest Four Corners region, near the conjunction of Utah, Colorado, New Mexico, and Arizona. Most of the region belongs to the Hopi, Ute, Zuni, and Navajo nations.
In the spring of 1974, three Navajo boys were killed by white teenagers out Indian rolling. A term for driving around looking for natives to harass, assault, or in this case, execute. Instead of going to prison, though, the perpetrators were sent to reform school. Jean traveled to New Mexico that year to show solidarity with the families of the murdered children. But violence against Indians was a plague everywhere, and nowhere was it worse than on Pine Ridge. So after the conference, Jean headed up to South Dakota to live in Oglala at the AIM camp on the Jumping Bull compound.
Back then, Jean was a pretty typical teenager, curious, strong-headed, rebellious, and her mom, who was close friends with Leonard, hoped a summer at the AIM camp would help her connect with her culture and teach her some discipline.
We're helping the grandma and grandpa Jumping Bull where we're staying at. Some of the guys were going to the Sundance, and we had sweat lodges, and we just put in a garden.
Life on the compound could be idyllic, but much of the reservation in those days, as we heard in part one of this episode, resembled a war zone.
And so people that were even, what would you say, friendly or, you know, friends with AIM or anything like that, then they would be targeted. Or anybody that considered traditional, or even people that were practicing their traditional ways, were targets. We have the whole Reign of Terror, which was like 1975 is when the Oglala shootout happened. 73 was when Wounded Knee happened. So that time there, and continually, but that time was really bad. You couldn't even walk on the street. Everybody lived by the law of the gun. Everybody.
In the early 90s, when Michael Apted was working on his film, Incident at Oglala, he interviewed Leonard Peltier at length about the shootout. But besides the clips that he used in the documentary, the remaining footage is inaccessible, locked in a storage unit somewhere, or simply thrown away. He did, however, have all the audio transcribed.
We don't have Leonard's voice, but we do have his memories on paper. So Peter Coyote, who has advocated for Leonard's release for decades, has done us the enormous favor of helping bring Leonard's words to life. If Peter's voice sounds familiar, it's because he narrated Ken Burns and Lynn Novick's documentaries, The Vietnam War, Country Music, The National Parks, The Dust Bowl, The Roosevelts. Oh, and he decided to change his name after a mescaline trip where he realized the coyote was his spirit animal. He's awesome. We know he's honored to support Leonard by participating in this podcast, and we're honored to have his help. Last thing, Leonard is still perfectly capable of telling us his story in his own voice, but the Bureau of Prisons in Washington continues to block us and other journalists from visiting him or interviewing him by phone.
Back in 1991, Apted asked Leonard to walk him through what happened at Jumping Bull on June 26, 1975. So here's what Leonard said, read by Peter Coyote.
I was down in camp. We had that teepee there and a couple of tents right by the creek. And that morning when I heard the shooting, I was still in the tent.
Earlier, on the morning of June 26, one of Dick Wilson's goons had been upstream on the creek shooting fish with an assault rifle.
It was disturbing a lot of people. They knew he was a Dick Wilson supporter, right? So I went up there to him and I asked him what he was doing. He said he was shooting fish. Anyway, we heard this shooting again and I said, "Man, you know, it's probably that guy up there shooting fish again, trying to terrorize everybody, right?"
But soon it was clear that it wasn't just one shooter. Multiple guns were going off, and people in the camp began to panic.
There was a lot of hysterics. Everyone was saying, "Hey, we're under attack."
Leonard's first concern was that the members of the Jumping Bull family, including infant children, might be caught in the crossfire.
So I grabbed a piece and I said to Bob Robidoux, "Look, we got to get these women and children out of that place, man, you know? There's little babies there." I thought the old folks were there.
Cecilia and Harry Jumping Bull had left the property that morning to go to a cattle auction nearby, but Leonard didn't know that at the time.
But we all had a choice and we met up with Leonard and he told us, "I'm sorry, you kids are all here. You know, if you want, you know, you have a choice here. We're going out this way. And you can turn yourself in and go up on top of the hill."
This is Gene Roach again.
My brother did that because he was only 11. He didn't have a choice, him. He said, "You got to, you know, you have no choice. You got to go up there." But so he went up after we had this little meeting. And as soon as he got on top of the hill, he could hear nothing but gunshots. So we didn't know until like that evening if he was shot or not, you know. You know, we didn't know until like midnight, and I can't remember how we found out that my brother was still alive because, you know, last thing we knew, he went up the hill and got shot.
I come running into the area, and man, I heard all this shooting going on. I felt bullets going over my head.
Leonard again.
I heard some zing go by, so I hit the ground. Man, what the hell's going on? I couldn't really see anything from where I was laying, though, right? And I got up. I was over by the tree line, and I was going to make a dash for that house, right? I was really concerned about Grandma Jumping Bull. I figured that they was probably terrorized. I was happy they weren't there when I got up there. I did some firing back. You know, I'm not going to lie and say I didn't, you know. I was being shot at. I was. There was a lot of firing going on from the other BIA police and other agents that were there. There's still a lot of gunfire going on. It just didn't stop then. I mean, those BIA police and stuff were still shooting. I know their cars. I could see their cars out there. So, I mean, I knew they were there. So everybody said, "What are we going to do?" I said, "Well, the only thing we can do is get the hell out of here, you know?" I said, "Let's just drive right out of here. Drive right across the road. You know, get across the road. Just jump the vehicle and hit the bush. If we have to, we shoot our way out. Everybody just stick their gun out the windows and start shooting, right?" They panicked about that idea. They said, "No, no, 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 we can't do that. There's too many cops over there, you know? It's suicide.
The feds had the property completely surrounded, and the AIM members were outnumbered 10 to 1. So as dusk fell, it seemed like just a matter of time before the agents sieged the compound. Complicating matters was the fact that none of the AIM members really knew the terrain. Leonard was an enrolled member of the Turtle Mountain Chippewa. He grew up in North Dakota. Gene was from Rapid City. Dino Butler and Bob Robidoux were both born in Portland and raised in the Pacific Northwest.
But by some wild stroke of luck, one of the kids in the AIM party discovered a culvert, a drainage pipe, where the stream flowing through the Jumping Bull compound crossed under Highway 18. The culvert wasn't big. You had to crawl through it on your belly for more than 50 yards. But it was literally an escape tunnel. The only problem was, it passed directly beneath the Bureau of Indian Affairs checkpoint. But Leonard, Gene Roach, Dino Butler, Bob Robidoux, and the rest of the crew wriggled into the culvert. Mike Anderson, though, one of the boys who'd chosen not to surrender himself, started to panic. Leonard recalls trying to talk Mike down.
"Be cool, man. I says you ain't got that much more longer. Man, he says, I just want to get out of here. I don't want to be trapped in here. I says, hey, we're not going to let you be trapped in there. Don't panic. But he says, I'm leaving. I'm going out the other way. I said, man, don't do that. I'm going. I'm going, he says. And he started crawling backwards, right? I said, man, hold it. Hold it right there. Don't go out and don't go back further. And I told everybody, Dino and Bob and the rest of them, I says, man, we got to get out of here. This guy's panicking. I said, we can't wait. We got to go. I told the women, I said, you guys take the lead. Go. Just go, I says. We'll meet up there, you know. We'll be right behind you. So they all took off. And then sure enough, the plane spotted us.
While they'd been lying in the culvert, they could hear an FBI surveillance plane circling overhead.
But then he left, right? He must have run out of gas, so we started running up the hill.
On the northeast side of Highway 18 was a large tree-topped hill. If they could get there, they felt, they'd be safe. But getting there was treacherous. Here's Gene Roach again.
Finally, when that plane left them, they said, go ahead and start running. So we had like about maybe a mile, maybe a half a mile, I don't know, measurement, but nothing but grass, no trees, nothing. We had to run to this rock to get around behind. And the same time when he was running, they were shooting at us all over.
I waited till everybody took off, and then I ran. I caught up to everybody, and I seen everybody just running. But they're not turning around, watching their backs or nothing. So I started hollering. I started screaming. We're receiving a lot of fire from the rear now. I mean, we can hear there's massive gunfire going on. So I said, man, what are you guys doing? You guys are going to get killed. Turn around and fire back, for Christ's sake. So anyway, the first part of the group made it to the top. I was the last one up the hill, and I kept feeling the bullets going by me. Norman Brown had the canteen shot off his hip. Fortunate they were so far away, but they were doing some real good sniping, man. Pretty good shooting from that distance, right?
By the time Leonard reached the top of the rise, there were still hours of daylight left. None of the AIM camp members were local to the area, and they didn't know the terrain well enough to seek out another escape route. So despite their strategic position at the top of the hill, the feds had them cornered again. And that's when, like something out of a vision, two men rode up on horseback.
So while we're sitting up there just seeing what the hell's going on, you know, and these two guys come up on horseback.
Gene Roach again.
And it's real funny because we're just sitting there, you know, just kind of resting, trying to digest the situation of the day. Well, hey, how's it going? All casual, you know. It's like a joking matter, but it really wasn't. But it was like, you guys okay, you know? But it was just so casual the way they came up. How you guys doing today? You know? Oh, well, we're okay now, you know.
And I asked them first. I said, what are you guys doing here?
Leonard again.
They said, well, hey, this is our people too. This is our fight too, you know. We're Oglalas. We're defenders of the 1868 treaty, so we have a right to be here. And I said, well, yeah, that's good. I'm not criticizing you for it, but you know, this is a heavy situation going on here. We don't know if we're going to make it out of here. We might all be dead before the night's over. And they said, well, we've made that choice to come and die with you guys, if that's what it is. But we're, you know, we're not going to die. We're going to get out of here, right?
As night fell, while a few AIM members held the hill with rifle fire, the two Oglala horsemen spirited the others away, two at a time. Within an hour, Leonard and the rest of the crew had been evacuated to the safe house of an elder who lived nearby. And because they'd escaped on horseback, the FBI search dogs couldn't immediately follow their scent.
We went to his old grandpa's house, maybe about, I don't know, real late, 2 or 3 in the morning. And the way he answered the door, I always remember that. He goes, oh, come in. Always come in. There's about, I think, 11 of us, you know. Hi, how you guys doing? No questions, nothing, you know. You guys want something to eat or, you know. But we couldn't stay there because at the time, the feds were doing door-to-door searches. You know, they were just, like, outrageous, breaking every law there was in the very beginning to the end, you know.
The AIM members rested for a little while at the elder's house, and he shared with them what knowledge he could about navigating the land. And before dawn began to break, Leonard, Gene, Dino, Bob, and the rest of the fugitives slipped back into the night.
We made a place somewhere in the hillside and hid ourselves, you know, from the helicopters, whatever. The technology isn't like today, we would have been dead. But we stayed there all day during the daylight, and he told us how to take an old fire trail way out there and walk, you know, to Manderson, because that's like an AIM community.
The he Gene references here is the elder who'd given them refuge the night before. But the next night, they picked up the wrong trail and got turned around. Instead of finding Manderson, they doubled back into the village of Pine Ridge, which the FBI was using as its main operating base on the reservation.
In the next episode, we'll be hearing directly from filmmaker and journalist Kevin McKiernan. Back in June 1975, freelancing for the New York Times, McKiernan traveled out to Pine Ridge to interview AIM leader Dennis Banks. Banks was on trial for his role in the Custer Courthouse riots and was staying at the AIM camp on the Jumping Bull compound. McKiernan happened to sleep over as a guest of the Jumping Bulls the night of June 25th. And the next morning, June 26, 1975, he was sitting in the back of the courtroom in Custer when word reached him that shots had been fired back on the ranch. So he jumped in his truck and drove into the center of the action.
These federal cars continue to race up and down the roads, over the ridges, rolling plains. Outside of that, it's quiet. But from where I am, I can see little Indian children playing by these tar paper shacks. Horses continue to play in the meadows. There appears to be some problem already between the BIA and the FBI and the U.S. Marshals Service. There's some firing now. Some problem as to who has command here. This was one of the problems at Wounded Knee. And Wounded Knee is only a relatively few miles from here. It's the same problem on Indian reservations of jurisdiction and the hierarchy of government command off the reservation when it comes onto the reservation simply has always been a boondoggle. There's more firing.
This podcast is produced, written, and edited by Rory Owen Delaney, James Kalin, and Andrew Fuller. And it was recorded on Tongva land in what is now considered Los Angeles. Thanks to Maya Meinert, Emily Deutsch, and Blessing Yen for helping support us while we do what we hope is important work. Thanks to Bobby Halverson for the original music we're using throughout the series. And thanks to Mike Cassantini at the Network Studios for his engineering assistance. and to Peter Lauridsen and Sycamore Sound for their audio mixing.
Thanks to Michael Apted for the reporting he did for his film Incident at Ogallala and for giving us access to his interview transcripts. Thanks to Kevin McKiernan for giving us permission to use the audio from his reporting on Pine Ridge in 1975. And as always, for helping us fact-check this episode. We're also excited to officially welcome him aboard as a consulting producer. Thanks to Paulette Doté at the International Leonard Peltier Defense Committee. Thanks to Kathy Peltier, Anne Begay, and Rigo 23 for encouraging us to tell this story. Thanks to Jean Roach for sharing her memories of the shootout. Thanks to Edgar Bearrunner for guiding us through his land and his history. Thanks to Peter Coyote for literally giving Leonard a voice when all we had were his words on paper. And thanks, most of all, to Leonard Peltier.
To get involved and help Leonard, sign the new clemency petition at freeleonardpeltier.com. For more information, go to whoisleonardpeltier.info or find us on social media at Leonard_pod on Twitter and Instagram or facebook.com/Leonard Podcast.
This podcast is a production of Man Bites Dog Films, LLC. Free Leonard Peltier.